Chapter 8. A Lady's Skirts. Byron's throat was growing dry. He could have beaten either of the guards in a fair fight. He knew that, and he itched for the chance. He might even have made a satisfactory showing against both together, but they both had the whips, and he couldn't have lifted an arm without having them demonstrate the fact. Inside his mind, he surrendered. There was no other way. But Gilbert said, "Let him take his cloak, man." Byron, startled, looked quickly toward the little man and retracted that same surrender. He knew he had no cloak. The guard whose weapon was out clicked his heels as a gesture of respect. He motioned his whip at Byron.
"You heard, my lord. Get your cloak and snap it up."
Byron stepped back as slowly as he dared. He retreated to the bookcase and squatted, groping behind the chair for his non-existent cloak. As his fingers clawed at the empty space behind the chair, he waited tensely for Gilbert. The visisoner was just a queer knobbed object to the guards. It would mean nothing to them that Gilbert fingered and stroked the knobs gently. Byron watched the muzzle of the whip intensely and allowed it to fill his mind. Certainly nothing else he saw or heard, thought he saw or heard, must enter. But how much longer? The armed guard said,
"Is your cloak behind that chair? Stand up."
He took an impatient step forward and then stopped. His eyes narrowed in deep amazement and he looked sharply to his left. That was it. Byron straightened and threw himself forward and down. He clasped the guard's knees and jerked. The guard was down with a jarring thud, and Byron's large fist closed over the other's hand, grasping for the neuronic whip it contained. The other guard had his weapon out, but for the moment, it was useless. With his free hand, he was brushing wildly at the space before his eyes. Gilbert's high-pitched laugh sounded.
"Anything bothering you, Farrell?"
"Don't see a thing," he grunted, and then, "except this whip I've got now."
"All right, then leave. They can't do anything to stop you.
Their minds are full of sights and sounds that don't exist."
Gilbert skipped out of the way of the writhing tangle of bodies. Byron wrenched his arms free and heaved upward. He brought his arm down solidly just below the other's ribs. The guard's face twisted in agony and his body doubled convulsively. Byron rose, whip in hand.
"Careful," cried Gilbert.
But Byron did not turn quickly enough. The second guard was upon him, bearing him down again. It was a blind attack. What it was the guard thought he was grasping, it was impossible to tell. That he knew nothing of Byron at the moment was certain. His breath rasped in Byron's ear, and there was a continuous, incoherent gurgle bubbling in his throat. Byron twisted in an attempt to bring his captured weapon into play, and was frighteningly aware of the blank and empty eyes that must be aware of some horror invisible to anyone else. Byron braced his legs and shifted weight in an effort to break loose, quite uselessly. Three times he felt the guard's whip flung hard against his hip and flinched at the contact. And then the guard's gurgle dissolved into words. He yelled, "I'll get you all!" And the very pale, almost invisible shimmer of the ionized air in the path of the whip's energy beam made its appearance. It swept wide through the air, and the path of the beam intersected Byron's foot. It was as though he had stepped into a bath of boiling lead, or as if a granite block had toppled upon it, or as if it had been crunched off by a shark. Actually, nothing had happened to it physically. It was only that the nerve endings that governed the sensation of pain had been universally and maximally stimulated. Boiling lead could have done no more. Byron's yell tore his throat raw, and he collapsed. It did not even occur to him that the fight was over. Nothing mattered but the ballooning pain. Yet, though Byron did not know it, the guard's grip had relaxed, and minutes later, when the young man could force his eyes open and blink away the tears, he found the guard backed against the wall, pushing feebly at nothing with both hands, and giggling to himself. The first guard was still on his back, arms and legs spread-eagled now. He was conscious, but silent. His eyes were following something in an erratic path, and his body quivered a little. There was froth on his lips. Byron forced himself to his feet. He limped badly as he made his way to the wall.
He used the butt of the whip, and the guard slumped. Then back to the first, who made no defense either, his eyes moving silently to the very moment of unconsciousness. Byron sat down again, nursing his foot. He stripped the shoe and stocking from it and stared in surprise at the unbroken skin. He chafed it and grunted at the burning sensation. He looked up at Gilbert, who had put down the visisonar and was now rubbing one lean cheek with the back of his hand. "Thank you," said Byron, "for the help of your instrument." Gilbert shrugged. He said, "There'll be more here soon. Get to Artemisia's room, please, quickly." Byron realized the sense of that. His foot had subsided to a quiet quiver of pain, but it felt swollen and puffy. He put on a stocking and tucked the shoe under his elbow. He already had one whip, and he relieved the second guard of the other. He stuffed it precariously within his belt. He turned at the door and asked with a sense of crawling revulsion, "What did you make them see, sir?"
"I don't know. I can't control it. I just gave them all the power I could, and the rest depended on their own complexes. Please, don't stand there talking. Do you have the map to Artemisia's room?"
Byron nodded and set off down the corridor. It was quite empty. He could not walk quickly, since trying to do so made his walk a hobble. He looked at his watch, then remembered that he had somehow never had the time to adjust it to Rhodian local chronometry. It still ran on standard interstellar time as used aboard ship, where 100 minutes made an hour, and 1,000 a day. So the figure 876, which gleamed pinkly on the cool metal face of the watch, meant nothing now. Still, it had to be well into the night, or into the planetary sleeping period at any rate, supposing that the two did not coincide. As otherwise, the halls would not be so empty, and the bas-reliefs on the wall would not phosphoresce unwatched. He touched one, idly, as he passed, a coronation scene, and found it to be two-dimensional. Yet it gave the perfect illusion of standing out from the wall. It was sufficiently unusual for him to stop momentarily in order to examine the effect. Then he remembered and hurried on. The emptiness of the corridor struck him as another sign of the decadence of Rhodia. He had grown very conscious of all these symbols of decline now that he had become a rebel. As the center of an independent power, the palace would always have had its sentries and its quiet wardens of the night. He consulted Gilbert's crude map and turned to the right, moving up a wide, curving ramp. There might have been processions here once, but nothing of that would be left now. He leaned against the proper door and touched the photo signal. The door moved ajar a bit, then opened wide. "Come in, young man." It was Artemisia. Byron slipped inside, and the door closed swiftly and silently. He looked at the girl and said nothing. He was gloomily conscious of the fact that his shirt was torn at the shoulder so that one sleeve flapped loosely, that his clothes were grimy, and his face welted. He remembered the shoe he was still carrying, dropped it, and wriggled his foot into it. Then he said, "Mind if I sit down?" She followed him to the chair and stood before him, a little annoyed. "What happened? What's wrong with your foot?" "I hurt it," he said shortly. "Are you ready to leave?" She brightened. "You'll take us, then?" But Byron was in no mood to be sweet about it. His foot still twinged, and he cradled it. He said, "Look, get me to a ship. I'm leaving this damn planet. If you want to come along, I'll take you." She frowned. "You might be a little more pleasant about it. Were you in a fight?" "Yes, I was, with your father's guards who wanted to arrest me for treason, so much for my sanctuary right."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
"I'm sorry, too. It's no wonder the Tirani can lord it over 50 worlds with a handful of men. We help them. Men like your father would do anything to keep in power. They would forget the basic duties of a simple gentleman. Oh, never mind."
"I said I was sorry, Lord Rancher." She used the title with a cold pride. "Please don't set yourself up as a judge of my father. You don't know all the facts."
"I'm not interested in discussing it. We'll have to leave in a hurry before more of your father's precious guards come. Well, I don't mean to hurt your feelings. It's all right."
Byron's surliness canceled out any meaning to his apology, but damn it, he had never been hit by a neuronic whip before, and it wasn't fun. And, by space, they had owed him sanctuary, at least that much. Artemisia felt angry. Not at her father, of course, but at the stupid young man. He was so young. Practically a child, she decided. Scarcely older than herself, if that. The communicator sounded, and she said sharply, "Please wait a minute and we'll go." It was Gilbert's voice, sounding faintly.
"Arta? All right at your end?"
"He's here," she whispered back.
"All right, don't say anything. Just listen. Don't leave your room. Keep him there. There's going to be a search of the palace, which there's no way of stopping. I'll try to think of something, but meanwhile, don't move."
He waited for no reply. Contact was broken.
"So that's that," Byron said. He had heard also. "Shall I stay and get you into trouble, or shall I go out and give myself up? There's no reason to expect sanctuary anywhere on Rhodia, I suppose."
She faced him in a rage, crying in a choked whisper. "Oh, shut up, you big, ugly fool!" They glared at each other. Byron's feelings were hurt. In a way, he was trying to help her, too. There was no reason for her to be insulting. She said, "I'm sorry," and looked away.
"That's all right," he said coldly, without meaning it. "You're entitled to your opinion."
"You don't have to say the things you do about my father. You don't know what being director is like. He's working for his people, whatever you may think."
"Oh, sure, he has to sell me to the Tirani for the sake of the people. That makes sense."
"In a way, it does. He has to show them he's loyal. Otherwise, they might depose him and take over the direct rule of Rhodia. Would that be better?"
"If a nobleman can't find sanctuary—"
"Oh, you only think of yourself. That's what's wrong with you. I don't think it's particularly selfish not to want to die, at least for nothing. I've got some fighting to do before I go. My father fought them."
He knew he was beginning to sound melodramatic, but she affected him that way.
She said, "And what good did it do your father?"
"None, I suppose. He was killed."
Artemisia felt unhappy. "I keep saying I'm sorry, and this time I really mean it. I'm all upset."
Then in defense,
"I'm in trouble, too, you know."
Byron remembered. "I know. All right, let's start all over." He tried to smile. His foot was feeling better anyway. She said, in an attempt at lightness, "You're not really ugly."
Byron felt foolish.
"Oh, well."
Then he stopped, and Artemisia's hand flew to her mouth. Abruptly, their heads turned to the door. There was the sudden, soft sound of many ordered feet on the semi-elastic plastic mosaic that floored the corridor outside. Most passed by, but there was a faint, disciplined heel clicking just outside the door, and the night signal purred. Gilbert had to work quickly. First, he had to hide his Visi sonar. For the first time, he wished he had a better hiding place. Damn Henrik for making up his mind so quickly this once, for not waiting till morning. He had to get away. He might never have another chance. Then he called the captain of the guard. He couldn't very well neglect a little matter of two unconscious guards and an escaped prisoner. The captain of the guard was grim about it. He had the two unconscious men cleared out and then faced Gilbert. "My lord, I am not quite clear from your message exactly what happened," he said.
"Just what you see," said Gilbert. "They came to make their arrest, and the young man did not submit. He is gone, space knows where."
"That is of little moment, my lord," said the captain. "The palace is honored tonight with the presence of a personage, so it is well guarded despite the hour. He cannot get out, and we will draw the net through the interior." "But how did he escape? My men were armed. He was not."
"He fought like a tiger from that chair behind which I hid."
"I am sorry, my lord, that you did not think to aid my men against an accused traitor."
Gilbert looked scornful.
"What an amusing thought, Captain. When your men, with doubled advantage in numbers and weapons, need help from myself, it is time you recruited yourself other men."
"Very well. We will search the palace, find him, and see if he can repeat the performance."
"I shall accompany you, Captain."
It was the captain's turn to raise his eyebrows. He said, "I would not advise it, my lord. There would be some danger." It was the kind of remark that one did not make to a Henriad. Gilbert knew that, but he only smiled and let the wrinkles fill his lean face. "I know that," he said, "but occasionally I find even danger amusing." It took 5 minutes for the company of guards to assemble. Gilbert, alone in his room during that time, called Artemisia. Byron and Artemisia had frozen at the purring of the little signal. It sounded a second time, and then there was a cautious rap upon the door, and Gilbert's voice was heard. "Do let me try, Captain," it said. Then more loudly, "Artemisia?" Byron grinned his relief and took a step forward, but the girl put a sudden hand upon his mouth. She called out, "One moment, Uncle Gil," and pointed desperately to the wall. Byron could only stare stupidly. The wall was quite blank. Artemisia made a face and stepped quickly past him. Her hand on the wall caused a portion of it to slide noiselessly aside, revealing a dressing room. Her lips motioned a "get inside," and her hands were fumbling at the ornamental pin on her right shoulder. The unclasping of that pin broke the tiny force field that held an invisible seam tightly closed down the length of the dress. She stepped out of it. Byron turned around after stepping across what had been the wall, and its closing endured just long enough for him to see her throwing a white fur dressing gown across her shoulders. The scarlet dress lay crumpled upon the chair. He looked about him and wondered if they would search Artemisia's room. He would be quite helpless if a search took place. There was no way out of the dressing room but the way he had entered, and there was nothing in it that could serve as a still more confined hiding space. Along one wall there hung a row of gowns, and the air shimmered very faintly before it. His hand passed easily through the shimmer, with only a faint tingling where it crossed his wrist. But then it was meant to repel only dust, so that the space behind it could be kept aseptically clean. He might hide behind the skirts. It was what he was doing, really. He had manhandled two guards, with Gilbert's help, to get here, but now that he was here, he was hiding behind a lady's skirts. A lady's skirts, in fact. Incongruously, he found himself wishing he had turned a bit sooner before the wall had closed behind him. She had quite a remarkable figure. It was ridiculous of him to have been so childishly nasty a while back. Of course she was not to blame for the faults of her father. And now he could only wait, staring at the blank wall, waiting for the sound of feet within the room, for the wall to pull back once more, for the muzzles facing him again, this time without a visi sonar to help him. He waited, holding a neuronic whip in each hand.